I may be setting a record this morning for extracurricular announcements, but I need to do it. One very happy announcement. Sonia Kneller and her husband Lynn are the very pleased parents of a 9-pound baby girl named Tara Lynn. Those of you who were here last week will know what a happy announcement that is. Sonia was eager for this event. If you were to ask me to name the man I think is the finest and most distinguished minister in the city of Wichita, I would give you the name of a man who is present this morning, Bill Rees. Bill, it's nice to have you here. Bill has recently retired, I think, from his church, and I suppose is visiting around a bit. Nice to have you in the audience. If I had known a little sooner, I would have asked you to come up and take my place. If you're one of our welcome visitors this morning, it may help to know that we've been talking about the personality traits which the Apostle Paul says should result from a life modeled on the life of Christ: joy, love, peace, patience, kindness, goodness. And now number 7 in Paul's list, called in different versions fidelity or steadfastness, but most often by a word that's not much in vogue or very exciting: faithfulness. A dictionary definition doesn't make your pulse beat any faster. Steadfast fidelity to whatever one is bound to by a pledge, duty, or obligation. In other words, I said I would, so I will. I may have lost you already, because in a high-tech age, that sounds about as dramatic as cold oatmeal. We pay lip service, of course, to that idea, and we're pleased when somebody else's fidelity ministers to our own comfort or profit. But I've never seen it at the top of anyone's list of cherished personal traits. And this must have been true forever, because Jewish and Christian scripture talk about faithfulness constantly, which is a sure sign that people had to be reminded, even threatened, to keep them loyal. One of the most bizarre tales in Hebrew scripture encourages the Jewish tribes to be faithful to the commandments of their God, no matter how dreadful at times the personal cost might be. It was a favorite lesson in Sunday school because it scared the kids into paying attention for a while. A frightening and suspenseful story, more like a Stephen King novel than something you expect to find in the Bible. That moment when Abraham is told by God to sacrifice his beloved son as a burnt offering. Now, Bill, you've wandered into a church with a liberal minister, so take a good grip on your seat, because I'm about to tell you something. May not surprise you. I cannot talk about this story comfortably until I tell you that I do not for one moment believe it to be literally true. I feel better. I knew you were a distinguished minister. Like thousands of other students of biblical literature and Bill Rees, I read it as a piece of sacred fiction designed to teach a lesson, a kind of parable of the ultimate faithfulness. It pictures a God I cannot imagine from the teachings of Jesus, a God willing to put a father and son through a horrifying experience in order to test the Father, despite the fact that since God is omniscient, He already knows the answer from the start. Read it not as history, but as a paradigm of human obedience pushed to the absolute limit. You know the story. When Abraham hears the appalling word that he must take his child to a nearby mountain, tie him up, stretch him out on a pile of kindling, cut his throat and burn him, we wonder first about a God who would say such a thing, and we wonder next why Abraham doesn't put up at least a little resistance to the ultimate child abuse. Abraham is a wooden model of unquestioning obedience, a good propaganda figure for a piece of didactic fiction, but totally unrealistic. And in real life, Isaac would not be quite as passive as the boy in the story, but the author has no interest beyond his lesson. There is, of course, a sudden deus ex machina, as in Greek tragedy, a divine interference, and Isaac is saved in the nick of time. Now, we may wish that we could read about the peculiar conversation father and son must have had on the way back home. But the story has made the only point it cares about: rigid and unquestioning faithfulness. There is, by the way, as Bill knows so well, a very likely explanation as to why that story got into the Old Testament, a kind of substitutionary lesson that whereas once upon a time the Jewish people apparently sacrificed their own children to God, this story suggests to them, you don't have to do that anymore. God will accept a lamb in place of your child. But that gets complex, and if Bill hadn't been here, I wouldn't even have mentioned it. Centuries later, when the Jew named Jesus stressed the need for us to be faithful, his illustrations were not so primitive. A parable praises those who hear and hold fast the word in a good and sound heart, and so bear fruit faithfully. Another one makes the point that a person faithful in trivial things is likely also to be faithful in big ones. Although, to be honest about it, loyalty in small and mundane matters does not much appeal to most of us. If the world is watching, fine. If not, we can cheat a little. A great Victorian preacher by the name of Charles Kingsley understood that temptation and spoke to the majority of us who live ordinary lives. Listen, we are surely not sent into the world to get credit and reputations, but to speak such words as are given to us to speak, to do such acts as are given us to do, not heeding much, nor expecting to know whether they have effected anything or nothing. In less elegant language, we can prove ourselves as truly in a small circle as in a large one. And one of the key elements in fidelity is a kind of simple stubbornness. Someone asked Gentleman Jim Corbett, who at the time was the heavyweight boxing champion, what he thought was the most important thing a man had to do to reach that level in boxing. His answer was classic: fight one more round. We are skeptical of miracles, you and I, but what is more incredible than to have Nelson Mandela, after a lifetime in prison, mostly forgotten but quietly faithful to his principles, suddenly become a president. Year after year, he held on to his vision, stubbornly faithful. The truth of human life, I know, is always more complex than any catchy phrase we coin about it. But there is a lot of truth in the Duke of Wellington's remark that the British soldiers at Waterloo were no braver than Napoleon's men. They were just braver for 5 minutes more. I walked all around Waterloo one day, marveling at the intricate and fateful maneuvers on the battlefield. But I have marveled even more at the struggles in my own life. When I look back, I realize that easy victories taught me nothing, that perhaps they harmed me at times by ministering to complacence and arrogant expectation. Certain failures, despised at the moment, taught me much more. And stubborn fidelity to the mundane tasks of 1,000 ordinary days did more than either of them to shape what I became. We are the sum total of all those forgotten hours when we did faithfully the things we had to do. I read a true story the other day that pulls together all the threads of this sermon. It comes by way of the senior minister of a large congregational church in Seattle. His version of how our scripture text might translate in modern life. Remember the people Steve read about who said when they were praised for being faithful and compassionate to Christ, "When did we ever see you hungry, homeless, sick, or in prison?" And how he said, in doing those things for the most insignificant people, "You have actually done them to me." Now, my true story is not a literary masterpiece, but for my purpose with it, that may be good. It's as plain as the people it talks about, and I think you'll understand when I've read it why I saved it for just such a day as this. It goes on this fashion. The clothing bank was open from 10 to 4 every Wednesday in the church basement. The bank was actually a large closet with a section for hanging clothes and drawers underneath for boots and shoes. On Wednesdays at about 9:30, Gertrude and Vernette, you know it's a true story, no one would have made up those names to go together. Gertrude and Vernette came up the church walk. Even though Vernette, who had spent most of his life as a logger, was in his late 70s, he was still tall and lean. These days, he tilted forward a little as he walked or stood like a tree, leaning with the weight of the years. His wife, Gertrude, by contrast, seemed almost as wide as she was tall. She was not, however, fat. She was simply a farm wife who had settled. In the basement, Vernette would climb a chair and pull down the cardboard boxes. Gertrude would carefully put the contents out on the tables. It always surprised me to see how many tables were filled with boots and shoes, heavy wool suits, and long raincoats. As the day went on, anywhere between 2 and 10 people would follow Gertrude and Vernette down the stairs into the basement. Often late in the day, when it was starting to grow dark on winter days, a mother followed by two or three children, would descend the stairs. Gertrude would play with the children in a grandmotherly way, while Vernette helped the mother find what she was looking for. Gertrude and Vernette were not always in perfect spirits about the labor they had chosen. People would donate huge bags of unsorted, even unwashed clothes, and all manner of odds and ends for which Vernette could never find space. This irritated him. It also irritated him that some people made such a mess of the clothes as they looked through them. Some of us wondered, more often in our thoughts than out loud, if this faithfully tended clothing bank did any real good. After all, the Northwest had major economic problems. Could a few boxes of clothing make a difference? It seemed that more large-scale efforts, such as government intervention, were needed. But on Wednesdays, Gertrude and Vernette came, and so did those who needed what was stuffed in the big closet. Sometimes in the summer, I would hear from someone who had stopped at Gertrude and Vernette's house to buy vegetables from their large garden. People with children were likely to come away with an extra bag of this or a basket of that free of charge, and the prices were already ridiculously low. Along about November, Vernette, without any fanfare, would give whatever money he had made from his garden to the church. I don't know if the clothing bank was effective, but then in the parable of the Last Judgment, Jesus did not say anything about effectiveness. He only asked, "Did you feed the hungry? Did you clothe the naked? When I was in prison, did you come?" It's good to know that whether or not you can change the world, you can still be faithful. When you're not wielding a lot of power, it's easy to say, "What difference does it make what I do?" But maybe those who seem to be in charge, think of Nelson Mandela again for a moment, are not as powerful as they appear. Jesus only asks us, my Seattle minister friend goes on, only asks us to be faithful. There are Gertrudes and Vernettes in every congregation, and whether or not they make a difference to the world, I know, he says, they have made a difference to me. If you talked to Gertrude and Vernette, it seemed to them they had done little or nothing. Theirs was no fake humility. Their service to others was so much a part of their lives that they really did not give it much thought. When I would thank him, Vernette was always embarrassed. "It was nothing," he would say with a wave of his arthritic hand. Perhaps that's the way it is with the saints. Goodness is not planned. It's not a heroic decision or a clever calculation. It is an expression of who we are. Had I asked Vernette why he did what he did, I doubt that he could have told me. For him, it was not carefully thought out. It was simply an expression of his character. Who he was grew out of his faith. Here is the final paragraph. Listen carefully. I used part of it not long ago, so you may recognize a couple of things. The dying words of the German poet Goethe were, "Licht, mehr Licht, light, light, let there be more light." But when the 20th century Spanish philosopher Miguel de Unamuno reflected on those words, he said, "It is not more light we need, but more warmth." We die of cold, not of darkness. It is not the night that kills, but the frost. On Wednesday evenings, Vernet pulled his coat on and went down the walk. The year was heading toward its end, and night was coming on, even though it was only a quarter past four. Into their old station wagon, he and Gertrude climbed and headed back down the road. But even as darkness fell and a cold wind blew down off the hills, there seemed to be a light around that station wagon, and the world was a warmer place. Now, my dear friends, don't get hung up on literalism. You may not visit a prison or volunteer in a clothing bank, but you can be faithful in 100 ways to a dear friend who needs your love and understanding, to a poor and backward child who needs a tutor, to the man embarrassed still because he cannot read, to the old woman next door who gets a check monthly and is out of debt and eats well enough at the senior center but needs a wave now and then, a couple of friendly words as if she mattered. We die of cold, not of darkness.